Accession number 18037, Reel 2.
Gunfighter in competition with the Hurricane and the Spitfire.
It was a monoplane then?
It was a monoplane, yes. I've got a picture of it over there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a good, it was an 8-gun fighter, and it did fly with its 8 guns on, whereas the Spitfire didn't have 8 guns on when it first flew. They had to redesign the wings to get the guns in. One incident was rather interesting. When the Spitfire, because one of our my mates who we worked, he worked on the wings and things, I worked on controls and things of that description, we heard that the Spitfire, the first Spitfire, had landed at Brooklands because it was going on to one of the air displays, and owing to the weather conditions, it couldn't go any further than Brooklands, so it landed at Brooklands. So my friend and I, we were both cyclists, we decided to slip out and have a look at it and see what sort of a job they'd made of it. So we cycled across the aerodrome to look at it, and the fog was coming down a bit thick then. But we got over there and had a look, and as we were looking at it, the door opened and the boss and his and Boucher came in. So we had to disappear pretty rapidly. They never discovered that we'd been over there. Oh, well, I
worked. We were talking about Mutt Summers. When did he join the company? Do you remember?
Don't know.
Was it the beginning of the 30s?
I can't remember any dates like that. I haven't a clue. Don't know. It's probably in here in the...
Yes, on record.
It's probably in the book.
You were mentioning just now about the contrast in personality between Mutt Summers and Jock Bryce.
Oh, there was, yes. Well, Jock Bryce was a very particularly careful bloke, and he used to walk round the aircraft before he took off to make sure everything worked. You know, he used to operate the ailerons and the elevator and rudder and just see if it was all connected up properly. And he was very fussy. But he was a good pilot.
But you were really isolated from the manufacturing stage and the flying stage, were you, for drawing office?
I mean, not from the manufacturing so much. I was quite interested in the manufacturing side of things, but I used to go down into the factory quite a bit and talk to the various people down there, which they didn't seem to think was necessary. Well, we were only part of the thing. We were, you know, when you were designing something, it's interesting to get interested in, get the people. I know once I went down to the shop, in the machine shop, I think, and there was an alteration of one of the parts that we had to do suddenly. I had to go down the shop and alter the blueprint for the bloke that was working on it. He said, "Where does this bloody thing go then in the aeroplane?" I said, "Well, I'll show you if you can we go and look at it?" And I said, "Well, why not?" So I said, "Well, come on, let's go and have a look." So we went down into the erection shop to show him where this bit was fitted, because he'd made a lot of these bits on his lathe and didn't know what they were for or what they were doing. When we came back, I got told off by the boss of the machine shop for taking him away from his job. I said, "Well, I only took him down to show him where his part is. That's nothing to do with it. He's got to get on with his work. He's nothing to do with that. You know, that sort of thing." Because Custance was the machine shop manager at that time, and he was a little bit like that. But I used to go down and see him, and there was a group of blokes, fitters, that was under Wally Knight. Now, whether Wally Knight's still with us or not, I don't know, but he lived in Chertsey Road, Byfleet, and I was at school with him in Byfleet, actually, and in Byfleet Village Choir. And he had a group of blokes working on a gallery above the erecting shop, and they used to do a lot of the fitting of engine controls and flying controls and seats and things like that. And I used to spend quite a bit of time up there with them. And I started doing magnesium castings for various things instead of fabrication. And I used to go down to the machine shop where the bloke was checking on the first casting and you know, helping with the check over of the sizes of the casting, because some of them were quite big seat castings and things like that. But I wasn't all that popular with the design people for going into the factory, but I said, well, we're only part of the thing, we're only beginning of it, and they've got to make it, they might as well know something about it. It's all part of the same thing. Well, our job is to draw it, not to have anything to do with them. I said, well, our job is to design it with the help of them. So there's quite a lot of aeroplanes I've worked on, I suppose, most of them, mainly on flying controls. Now, in the end, I was on flying controls pretty well all the time under a group leader by the name of Comfort, you've probably heard of. He's now in Australia. He lost his wife a couple of years ago or more, and his son came back from Australia because his son works out there on some helicopter firm, and said, why don't you come out for a holiday, Dad? So he went out there and thought what a wonderful place it was. And he decided in the end to go. And at 92, he sold up his house or bungalow in Sunbury and went out to Australia to live with his son. And he's bought a house over there with the money he got from the bungalow in the Sunbury, which was an immaculate bungalow. He was able to buy a big house in Australia. Amazing.
Do you remember the time when the young George Edwards came to work at Vickers?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
What are your memories of that?
Well, he came in. He came in and he worked for George Stannard. But I was fairly close to where he worked on the board. I chatted to him, I suppose, like you always do. I always did when people came in. And he said, you know, he said, I'm absolutely mystified with all this lot.
Really?
Yeah. And he was, because he'd come from... Where did he come from? A firm in London somewhere, I think. But he did very well. And we always thought he was in the right place at the right time.
When you say he was mystified, was he weak on mathematics or something like that?
Oh, no, he wasn't. It was just a question. It was something entirely different. You know, bits of tin and stuff like that, aeroplanes were something he hadn't had much to do with before. Why he came there, I never found out, but...
He found his niche there, anyway.
Eh?
He certainly found his niche there.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Yes. Oh, yes, he got on very well. And, of course, he got on the right side of Sir Hugh Kilner when they were doing the degaussing ring on the Wellingtons. He more or less took charge of that and produced those, which was more or less made his name. That was quite an effort, those things, because they used... Ford motor car engine to drive the generator to generate the electricity to operate this big magnetic ring. Quite an effort that was. I also did some controls on the first jet job. We put a jet into the back end of a Wellington. You probably knew about that. And there was we put cable controls to operate it from the cockpit. I think I drew up those cable controls from the cockpit to the jet engine. It's a pity they didn't carry on with that, because they would have been the first to have a complete jet aeroplane. They used to use this as an experimental thing, normal engines, and then shut those down and operate the jet, and you know, it flew the aeroplane. The first one, they only did the one and nearly got shot down over the coast. They didn't know what it was over there. The observers never heard of it, never seen it. Wonder what it was, and nearly shot it down.
Because you went on to fit a couple of neens on a Viking, didn't you?
Oh, yes, yes. That was a very good job. I didn't have an awful lot to do with that. I don't know who did that, actually. I think Jack Thorne had much to do with that. You've probably heard of him. Mm. He's still about. He lives in Guildford. He's not a very fit man these days, I don't think, but he finished. He went down to Bristol. He finished at Bristol. Don't know what else there is of general interest.
You worked on the Wellesley, presumably, didn't you?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Was that Barnes Wallace's first major design?
Yes. Mm. That was a geodetic design, but it was a bit of a small aeroplane for that type of design. Then he went on from there on to the Wellington and the Type 1000 and various big aeroplanes. Some of them were built, some of them weren't. But the Wellesley was the original one, and it was only a small fuselage, really, and it wasn't the right sort of construction, really, for... But it was a beginning of something. Mm. But the Wellington, of course, proved that it was the right sort of stuff, because they used to come back with half the things shot away and still come home.
Well, so Wellesley had a very big span, didn't it?
Oh, yes, yes,
for its
yes.
long range.
Yes, it was a long-range job, and they did one or two long-range flights with it, extra tankage and all that sort of thing in it. But...
Do you often... think back to the years you spent at Vickers, you know, as I say, starting on the Beaming, finishing up on Concord, which really is an extraordinary short time span when you look at the technology in each aeroplane.
And yes.
Do you ponder this a lot?
The only not a lot, because, as I say, I left early. I didn't retire. I left with a pension at 60. Because I thought, well, after all these years I've been working on these aeroplanes, what is there left? What was there left to show? There's nothing really left to show in those when that happened. And I was very interested in architecture. And since I left there, I've done quite a number of jobs, architectural jobs, houses, alterations to places. But I had a little studio in Ripley. And I used to do my own thing there, and I had a print machine. I used to do my own prints and stuff, and I designed the Ripley Village Hall, which is going strong, and quite a number of things like that. But I met somebody only a few years ago that was on the aircraft business, and they said, "You're doing all right, aren't you, with your design work?" I said, "Well, not bad, I suppose." They said, "Well," he said, "I thought about this." He said, "I carried on till I was 65, and what have I got to show for it?" Nothing. Not exactly in those terms, but that's what he meant.
Well, Concorde's still flying around.
The Concorde's still
BC
flying.
BC-10 standing there at the museum now.
Yes, yeah.
Still flying for the RAF?
Oh, I know. That was one of the best aeroplanes we ever did, I think. The Viscount. It was a very good aeroplane. There's never been any trouble with it. There's never been any major disaster or anything. And it's still flying. There's still quite a number of them in the air. It was very good. And that was designed, we always say, by an enthusiastic group of people. Design section leaders and draftsmen. They were all very keen to do something good. And that was a result of it. Everybody was happy and satisfied and produced a good aeroplane.
It was also the right timing.
Oh, yes, the timing seemed to work out right.
I mean, the turboprop came in there. Which...
That's right. And it wasn't all that noisy.
No.
A lot like the pure jets. The pure jets were far too noisy. But they're going back to prop jets again now, aren't they?
Mm.
Yeah. Of course, George Edward had a lot to do with that, and so did Basil Stevenson. He was quite a fussy bloke with design. But there we are.
I'm interested in the extent that the community, I mean, you have Vickers there, which was a major employer, and obviously it's sort of spread out into the community. I mean, most people living in the Byfleet area seem to work there. Was there a lot of community spirit in the company? Were you aware of it when you were there?
Oh, I think so, yes. Of course, people knew one another by their Christian names quite a bit. And of course, Archie Knight, who was the works manager, he was everywhere. A cousin of mine was working at Great Western Railway Works. He was there as an apprentice. And when they finished their apprenticeship, they used to get slung out and said, go and get your, you know, use your experience elsewhere. He got a job down there at Byfleet at Weybridge. And old Knighty used to come rushing round, and he said, you know, that bloke's amazing. He goes out of one door, you think, oh, well, he's gone, he's out the way. A few minutes later, he's coming in through and down the door over there. He moves about all over the place. I said, well, he keeps his eye on everything. And then one day they were building the fuselage, I think, of one of the Valiant or something like that, down in the fitting shop. And my cousin said, how the hell are they going to get that into the erection shop? I said, you'll see. When it was ready to go, old Knight came in and, come on, you lot. Gathered all the fitters and everybody together, and they lifted this thing up manually and walked it through the doors into the erection shop. I said to him, there you are, that's how it's done. Because Knight was a bit of a crude bloke, but he used to get things done. And of course, the Brooklands track was being used in those days. You could only take stuff over at certain times because they were roaring round the concrete, and they used to be within a couple of feet of the doors. Now, if you wanted to go across the track, which you had to sometime to see a job or check up with something or other, old Knighty used to stand by the door, and somebody go by like that. He'd open the door, go on, go like hell. So you had to go out and run across the concrete.
Right in the middle of a race.
Right across the road, right across the concrete. By the time you got almost over the other side, this bloke was round again in the car.
So racing had priority over building aeroplanes then?
Oh, yes. The firm had to pay so much every time it took an aeroplane across the concrete onto the aerodrome.
Because did they own the whole site then, the Brooklands people?
Yes. As Vickers only owned the bit they were on. Yeah. Oh, yes, Brooklands owned the rest of it.
And it was a grass strip then, was it, in the 30s? You didn't have a runway there?
Oh, there was no runway, no. Oh, no. No.
You mentioned a saying of Sir Vance Wallace, you know, when I came in about...
Oh, yes.
The tea tray thing. Can you think of any others? Or mention that one?
Well...
His philosophies?
Yeah, well, he was very particular, and he thought that things should be properly designed and not use sort of brute force to get things into the air, because he said if you put enough engines on a tea tray, the bloody thing would fly. But he was all for design to get things done properly. And he reckoned that propellers were all wrong. He wanted to design a proper propeller, but he never did. How he was going to do that, I don't know. But of course, the jets came in then, and that sort of disappeared. But Langs used to make the propellers, and they used to make a very good job of them. But they did have a propeller section in the factory. They used to make their own propellers at one time. And they used to chip them out. They used to glue them up and chip them out with axes. Because a chap named Frank Wand, who lives in Queen's Avenue, Byfleet, he used to work there, and he worked in the propeller section before he came into the drawing office. His father was a carpenter.
And they're all fixed pitch, I suppose, in those days, weren't they? All fixed pitch propellers with their carpenter.
Oh, yes, they were just fixed pitch.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, there was no variable pitch then.
Yeah. And you tended to make virtually everything you wanted on site. You didn't buy much in then?
I don't think so. I don't think they bought anything in. I think they pretty well made everything.
Not like nowadays when an aeroplane is made in about half a dozen different factories.
Yes. Oh no, well, it's the same with motor cars, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're a collection of bits and pieces. No, they used to make everything there. As old Tommy Duncan used to design all the fuel cocks and petrol pumps and all those sort of things.
Yeah.
As I worked for Tommy Duncan for a time, and during the day sometimes I was working on petrol cocks or petrol pumps or hand pumps or something like that, and then on overtime we very often have to work on something else. And at one instance I know I was working for Tommy Duncan during the day and I was working for Paul Wine doing packing cases in the evening. There we are.
You mentioned your when you retired, you went on to house designs and so on. I mean, did you get more satisfaction out of that because you were doing the whole job, or?
Well, yes, it was very satisfactory. And you were sort of doing something there that was going to last for a long time.
Mm.
We hope. Anyway, there's a house in the back here. I don't know. You came in that way, did you?
Yeah.
There's a big house there that I designed.
And you see it every time you go by.
Eh?
You see it every time you go by.
I don't go by that much. I go this way quite a bit.
But it's easily visible, whereas
it's visible. Yeah,
the Wellington bomber is no longer
that's
around.
Right.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Well, we saved a lot of the Wellington drawings and things because at one stage they decided to scrap a lot of the old drawings to make room for the new stuff. Well. We were working in the model club, and I was chairman of the model club there for quite a time, and the president of our model club was a chap named Alf Pullen, who was a sort of roving foreman on the track. He worked directly for Tom Parker. And I heard that they were going to scrap all these drawings, which I thought was a great pity. So I mentioned it to him one day, and I said, Alf, I said, they've got to scrap all these old Wellington drawings. He said, oh, they shouldn't do that, should they? I said, well, I don't know what we can do about it. He said, all right, leave it with me. Well, he managed to find out when they were all loaded up on a trolley, they were all going to be down to the dump and burnt. So he stopped the bloke, because he was more or less in charge of all that lot. And we took all these drawings off the trolley, hid them away in another room, and then several of us went through them one Sunday morning and picked out the important ones and scrapped their bits and pieces, but the main assemblies and stuff like that, we kept all those. Now, when the Vimy was burnt in Australia, there was a Vimy out there that was burnt in transport, we managed to supply them with prints of all the bits and pieces they want. And they were highly delighted because they got all the drawings and they were able to make the bits, and it was all due to the fact that we'd saved these drawings from being scrapped.
Mm. That was long after the Vimy went out of production, presumably.
Oh, yes.
Well,
they wanted to sling all the stuff out the way. It wasn't any good. We didn't want to keep that rubbish. That we saved it for a good purpose, and the Australian people were highly delighted. Yes, yeah, so the Vimy, we had a very good model club there. We had a very good model maker by the name of Mike Shepherd, who was a chief draughtsman of the Gwynne Tunnel. And he made a wonderful model of the Vimy commercial, which we gave to the Science Museum.
I think I've seen it.
And that's on view with the ordinary Vimy and the model and the commercial Vimy. Yeah. They were very pleased with that.
And that was hobby modelling.